Ever get that feeling? Like you really want to understand something complicated, but you don't want to wade through a whole ocean of details.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
I mean, who has the time?
Right?
That's kind of the mission here, right?
Yeah.
Cut through the noise and get to the good stuff. And today, well, we're diving into something pretty fascinating, I think. How computers actually manage to understand language.
Not just recognizing words, right?
No.
But like really grasping the meaning, the intention behind them.
It's well, it's mind-boggling when you think about it.
It is.
So for this deep dive, we've got a stack of research papers, mostly from the world of, natural language processing, NLP. And our goal, well, to pull out the most important ideas about how these systems, how these computational systems actually represent meaning and why that even matters.
We're going to find out some pretty surprising things along the way, like the actual techniques they use to encode meaning. And yeah, I think there'll be a few aha moments for sure. Like, oh, that's how they do it.
Moments where you suddenly realize just how clever and sometimes how limited these computational approaches can be.
Absolutely.
So where do we even begin with this?
Well, a good place to start is with dependency parsing. It's a fundamental concept in how computers make sense of sentence structure.
Okay, dependency parsing. Sounds kind of technical. What's the basic idea?
So basically, it's all about figuring out the grammatical relationships between words in a sentence, not so much focusing on phrases, but more on the individual words and how they connect to each other. You identify the head word, the main word in a phrase or clause.
The boss, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly, the boss word. And then you figure out its dependence, the words that modify it or act as its arguments.
So, like, the cat sat on the mat. Sat would be the head word,
Right.
and cat and mat are dependent.
Exactly. You're building a kind of map of the sentence showing how the words relate to each other, who's in charge, and who's modifying whom.
And how does that differ from the old school sentence diagramming? The phrase structure diagrams we all learned in school.
Right. So with phrase structure diagrams, you're breaking things down into noun phrases, verb phrases, and so on. Dependency parsing skips over that. You mentioned it earlier. No phrasal constituents or lexical categories. It goes straight for those direct connections between words.
So it's more streamlined.
Yeah, you could say that. And the cool thing is that these direct connections often reflect the semantic relationships between words. Like if you have a verb, you immediately see its subject and object linked to it.
Because that's what the verb is acting on, right?
Precisely. And that's incredibly useful for NLP because it gives you a direct handle on the meaning, like who's doing what to whom.
So you're saying that dependency structures are kind of a shortcut to understanding the meaning of a sentence.
In a way, yeah. They cut through the syntactic fluff and highlight the core semantic relations.
Okay, so I'm getting a sense of how dependency structures work, but can you give me some specific examples of those relationships? Like, what kind of labels do we actually see on those connections?
Absolutely. So, for example, you have NSUBJ, which stands for nominal subject,
Okay.
like in the sentence, the dog chased the ball.
Dog would be the NSUBJ of chased.
Exactly. Then you have OBJ for direct object. So in that same sentence, ball would be the OBJ of chased.
Got it.
You also have IOBJ for indirect object, like in she gave him the book. Him would be the IOBJ. Then there's NMOD for a noun modifier.
Like the red ball.
Yeah, perfect example. Red would be an NMOD modifying ball. And you have AMOD for adjectival modifiers. DET for determiners like the, a, and so on. There are a bunch of others.
There's a whole vocabulary of grammatical relationships.
It is. Each label captures a specific way in which words relate to each other.
So you're not just connecting the words, you're labeling the connections with these tags.
Yeah, exactly. That's what makes dependency parsing so powerful. It gives you a very precise and detailed representation of the sentence structure.
Okay, so we've got this network of labeled connections.
Yeah.
How do computers actually represent this? Is it like a diagram or something?
You can visualize it as a diagram, but the underlying representation is actually a directed graph. The words are the nodes in the graph, and the relationships are the edges, the arrows pointing from the head to the dependent.
So it's like a network diagram.
Exactly, a network of grammatical relationships.
Okay, now the big question. How do we go from a plain sentence to this dependency structure? That's where the parsing comes in, right?
Exactly. Parsing is the process of analyzing the sentence and figuring out that dependency structure. And there are two main families of methods for doing that: transition-based parsing and graph-based parsing.
Okay, let's start with transition-based. How does that work?
So imagine you have a little machine, a parser, that reads the sentence word by word. And as it reads, it makes decisions about how to build the dependency tree. It has a few basic actions it can take.
So it's like building a puzzle, piece by piece.
Kind of, yeah. The parser keeps track of its progress in what's called a parser state.
What's in this parser state?
It usually has a stack, which is like a temporary holding area for words that are being actively processed. Then there's the input buffer, which holds the rest of the sentence that hasn't been read yet.
Yeah.
And then there's a set of dependency relations that have been established so far.
Okay, so the parser reads a word, looks at its state, makes a decision, and updates the state. Rinse and repeat. What kind of decisions can it make? What are those actions?
Right. In the ARC standard approach, which is one common type of transition-based parsing, there are three main actions: shift, left arc, and right arc. Shift is simple. It just takes the next word from the input buffer and puts it on the stack.
Okay.
Left arc creates a dependency relation between the two words on top of the stack, making the top word the dependent and the one below it the head. And then it removes the top word from the stack.
So left arc connects words going leftward from the top of the stack?
Exactly. Right arc does the same thing, but in the opposite direction. It makes the second word on the stack the dependent of the top word and removes the top word.
So it's like connecting the dots, but with specific rules about which direction you can connect them in.
That's a good way to think about it. And as the parser keeps making these shift, left arc, and right arc decisions, it gradually builds up the dependency tree.
Can you walk me through a quick example?
Sure. Let's say the sentence is, book me the morning flight.
Okay.
Initially, the stack is empty, except for a special root marker, and the whole sentence is in the input buffer. The first action would be shift, putting book on the stack, then another shift for me. Now we have two words on the stack, and we can apply a right arc.
Saying that me depends on book.
Exactly. Book is the head, me is the dependent, and the relation would be IOBJ, indirect object. Then we shift the shift morning, shift flight.
Okay, the stack is getting full.
Now we can do a left arc. Morning is dependent on flight with the relation compound. And then another left arc, the depends on flight, relation DE. And finally, a right arc connecting flight to book as the object.
And then one final right arc to connect book to the root.
Yeah, you got it. And that's how you get the complete dependency tree.
It's amazing how you can build this whole structure with just three simple actions. But I imagine it's not always that straightforward.
You're right. Sometimes there are multiple valid ways to parse a sentence, even for humans. And the basic transition-based parser is greedy.
Greedy.
It means it always chooses what looks like the best action at the moment without considering the long-term consequences. So it can make mistakes, get stuck in a dead end.
So what do you do about that?
There are techniques to make it more robust. One is using beam search. Instead of just keeping track of one best parsing state, you keep a beam, a small set of the most promising states, and explore multiple paths in parallel. That helps to avoid getting trapped by early mistakes.
Makes sense.
Another thing is, well, we haven't talked about the labels on those arcs, the NSUBJ, OBJ, and all that. That's labeled dependency parsing.
Right, because your example just showed how to connect the words, not how to label the connections.
Exactly. So in labeled parsing, those left arc and right arc actions, they also specify the label you want to assign. So you'd have left arc with the NSUBJ label, right arc with the OBJ label, and so on.
Okay, so it's even more complex because now the parser has to choose not just which action to take, but also which label to use.
Exactly. And to train a parser to do that correctly, we use supervised machine learning.
Which means?
We need a lot of training data, a bunch of sentences that have already been parsed by humans with the correct dependency trees. These collections are called tree banks.
And the parser learns from these examples.
Right. We use an oracle, which is essentially a function that can tell us for any given parser state what the correct action should have been based on the gold standard tree bank.
Okay, so we have this oracle, this perfect parser. But how do we actually train the real parser to be more like the oracle?
We use features. We extract a whole bunch of characteristics from the current parser state, like the words on the stack, the words in the buffer, they're part of speech tags, the dependency relations that have already been established.
So like clues, hints about what the next action should be.
Exactly. And we feed these features into a machine learning classifier. This classifier learns from the training data, from those examples where the oracle told us the correct action, and it tries to figure out which features are most predictive of each action.
So if the parser sees a certain combination of features, it knows, based on its training, that it should probably apply a left arc with the NSUBJ label, for example.
Exactly. It's all about pattern recognition.
It's incredible how much complexity is involved in parsing a simple sentence.
It is, and we've only scratched the surface. There's so many more advanced techniques, different transition systems like ARC-EAGR parsing, which is another popular one.
How is ARC-EAGR different from ARC standard?
It has a different set of actions and different rules for applying them. It tends to build rightward dependencies earlier, which can sometimes be more efficient.
Okay, so there are different flavors of transition-based parsing.
Yeah. And then there's a whole other approach, graph-based parsing.
How does that work?
Graph-based parsers don't look step-by-step like transition-based ones. They consider all possible dependency relations between all words in the sentence simultaneously.
So it's like looking at the big picture from the start.
Yeah, exactly. They create this fully connected graph where each word is a node, and there's a potential edge between every pair of words representing a possible head-dependent relation.
That sounds like a lot of edges.
It can be, but the key is that each edge has a score. The parser's job is to find the best tree within that graph, the one that maximizes the total score of its edges.
How do they assign scores to the edges?
Again, you can use features. And you can use very sophisticated scoring functions, like those based on neural networks. The idea is to learn a function that can accurately predict how likely it is that any two words have a particular dependency relation between them.
So it's like a giant optimization problem. Find the best tree out of all the possible trees.
You got it. And there are algorithms for doing that efficiently, like the Chu Liu Edmonds algorithm.
Okay, so we've seen two different approaches to dependency parsing. But how do we know how well they work? How do we evaluate them?
There are several standard evaluation metrics. One is labeled attachment score, or LAS, which measures what percentage of words have been assigned the correct head and the correct dependency label.
So it's like a measure of accuracy.
Yeah, for the individual word attachments. And then there's unlabeled attachment score, or UAS, which just looks at whether the head is correct, regardless of the label.
Okay, and how do those scores actually get calculated?
Let's say you have a sentence with five words. And the gold standard, the correct parse, has four dependency relations. If the parser correctly identifies three of those relations with the correct head and label, its LAS would be 75%.
Three out of four.
Right. And if it got the head right for all four relations, but the label wrong for one of them, its UAS would be 100%, but its LAS would be 75%.
Makes sense.
And then there are other metrics, like precision and recall, which give you a more detailed view of the performance on specific types of dependency relations.
You also mentioned something about universal dependencies.
That's a big deal. It's an initiative to create a consistent annotation scheme for dependency parsing across a whole bunch of languages. They've developed a set of guidelines and a universal set of dependency labels, which helps to standardize the field and make it easier to compare results across different languages.
So dependency parsing gives us a way to understand the grammatical structure of a sentence. But meaning goes beyond just grammar, right?
Yeah.
What about things like sentiment, the emotional tone of the language?
Absolutely. Dependency parsing is great for figuring out the who did what to whom part. But to really understand language, we also need to grasp the feelings and attitudes that are being expressed. That's where sentiment analysis and affect lexicons come in.
Okay, sentiment analysis, we talked about that before. It's about figuring out whether a piece of text is positive, negative, or neutral.
Right. But affect lexicons go a bit deeper. They try to capture a wider range of affective states.
Like what?
Well, emotions, of course. Things like joy, sadness, anger, fear. But also moods, which are more diffuse and long-lasting, like feeling cheerful or gloomy. Then there are interpersonal stances, like being friendly or hostile. And attitudes, which are more enduring evaluations of things, like liking or disliking something.
And how do you represent all of that in a computer?
One way is to use lexicons, lists of words that are strongly associated with particular affective states.
So you're basically saying these words tend to convey happiness, these words tend to convey sadness, and so on.
Exactly. And there are different types of lexicons. Sentiment lexicons focus mainly on the positive-negative dimension, the valence. But you can also have lexicons that incorporate other dimensions, like arousal.
Arousal?
Yeah, how calming or exciting a word is. And dominance, the sense of control or lack of control associated with a word.
So you can have a word that's both positive and arousing, like thrilled,
mm-hmm.
or positive and calming, like content.
Exactly. And these lexicons can be very useful for understanding the emotional tone of text.
Okay, but how do you actually create these lexicons in the first place?
There are a few methods. One is to just ask people. You can use crowdsourcing to have people write words on different emotional scales.
So, like, on a scale of 1 to 5, how much does this word make you feel happy?
Yeah, exactly. Or you can have them do comparison tasks, like choosing which of two words is more strongly associated with anger.
Sounds like a lot of manual work.
It can be, but there are also more automated methods, semi-supervised techniques that use a small set of seed words and then leverage word embeddings to expand the lexicon.
Word embeddings, those are like those vector representations of words that capture semantic similarity.
Exactly. So you start with a few words that you know are clearly positive or negative, and then you use the embeddings to find other words that are semantically close to them.
So if happy is one of your seed words, the algorithm might find joyful and cheerful because they're nearby in the embedding space.
Exactly. And you can also use existing semantic networks like WordNet to help build lexicons. Senti WordNet is a good example of that. It assigns sentiment scores to different senses of words in WordNet.
And you mentioned using review data, like from Yelp or Amazon.
Right. You can use the star ratings that people give to products or services as a way to learn which words are statistically associated with positive or negative sentiment.
So if a word appears a lot in 5-star reviews and very rarely in 1-star reviews, you can infer that it probably has a positive connotation.
Exactly. There are statistical techniques, like the log odds ratio, that can help you quantify those associations.
Okay, so we've got these sentiment and effect lexicons. How do we actually use them in NLP?
One way is to just use them as features in machine learning models. You can count how many positive and negative words appear in a text and use those counts as features.
So if a tweet has 5 positive words and 2 negative words, the model might predict that it's overall positive.
Right, but you can also use them in more sophisticated ways, like entity-centric sentiment analysis.
What's that?
Instead of just looking at the overall sentiment of a text, you look at the sentiment associated with specific entities mentioned in the text.
So, like in a movie review, you might want to know not just whether the review is positive or negative overall, but also what their reviewer thought of specific characters or plot points.
Exactly, and you can use lexicons to help with that. And then there are connotation frames.
Connotation frames, what are those?
They're kind of like lexicons, but they capture a more nuanced understanding of effective meaning. Instead of just saying this word is positive or this word is negative, connotation frames capture the effective relationships between words.
Can you give an example?
Sure. So the verb implore suggests a power dynamic where the person doing the imploring is in a weaker position than the person being implored.
Please, sir, I beg you.
Exactly. So a connotation frame for implore would capture that power dynamic.
Okay, so it's not just about individual words, it's about the relationships between words and the emotions or attitudes those relationships convey.
Precisely. It's another level of depth in understanding the emotional landscape of language.
So we've seen how computers can parse sentences, how they can analyze sentiment and emotion. But what about understanding meaning in a way that allows for logical reasoning?
That's where logical meaning representation comes in. We want to be able to represent the meaning of a sentence in a way that a computer can use to make inferences, to draw new conclusions from existing information.
So it's not just about recognizing patterns, it's about understanding the logical structure of the information.
Right. We want to be able to say, if A is true and B is true, then C must also be true. That kind of reasoning.
Okay, so how do we represent meaning in that way?
Yeah. One common approach is to use first order logic, or FOL. It's a formal language that allows you to represent objects, properties, and relationships in a very precise way.
Like all dogs are mammals.
Yeah, that's a classic example of a statement you can express in FOL. You can represent the concept of a dog, the concept of a mammal, and the relationship of being A.
And then you can use FOL to do things like if Fido is a dog and all dogs are mammals, then Fido is a mammal.
Exactly. FOL has a set of rules that allow you to make deductions, to derive new facts from existing facts.
It sounds very powerful.
It is. But FOL has some limitations. One is that it doesn't handle events very well.
Events.
Actions, things that happen, like John bought a book.
Okay.
In FOL, you typically represent that as a relation between John, a book, and the act of buying. But that can get messy when you have events with different numbers of participants or different
So
properties.
how do you handle that?
There's something called Neo-Davidsonian event representation, which treats events as individual entities. So John bought a book, would be represented as an event of buying, and then you'd have separate statements linking John to that event as the buyer, the book as the thing being bought, and so on.
So it's more flexible.
Yeah, you can add more information about the event without having to change the basic structure.
And you mentioned something about temporal logic.
Right, that's an extension of FOL that allows you to represent time, so you can talk about things happening in the past, present, or future.
Makes sense. So we've got this powerful way to represent meaning logically.
Mm.
But how do we get from a sentence to that representation?
That's a big challenge. That's the field of semantic parsing. There are a lot of different approaches, and it's still an active area of research. But one technique that's often used is semantic role labeling, or SRL.
What's that?
It's kind of like a shallow version of logical meaning representation. Instead of trying to capture the full logical structure, SRL focuses on identifying the main verb in a sentence and then labeling its arguments with semantic roles.
Semantic role.
Things like agent, patient, instrument, location, and so on. It's about understanding the role that each participant plays in the event.
So in John hit the ball with a bat, John would be the agent, ball would be the patient, and bat would be the instrument.
Exactly. SRL gives you a more detailed understanding of the meaning than just the grammatical roles of subject, object, and so on.
And how do you actually do SRL?
There are different approaches, but one common one is to use machine learning. You train a model on a data set of sentences that have been annotated with semantic roles, and then the model learns to predict the roles for new sentences.
And there are resources for that, like PropBank.
Right. PropBank is a large corpus of text that's been annotated with semantic roles. It's a very valuable resource for SRL research.
All right. So we've covered a lot of ground here. Dependency parsing, sentiment analysis, logical meaning representation, semantic role labeling. It's amazing how much progress has been made in getting computers to understand language.
It really is. And it's all driven by this desire to make computers more human-like, to enable them to communicate with us in a more natural way.
And it's not just about building cool technologies. It's also about understanding ourselves better, right?
Absolutely. By trying to teach computers how to understand language, we're also learning a lot about how we ourselves understand language.
It's like holding up a mirror to our own minds.
Exactly. And sometimes what we see in that mirror is surprising, even a little bit unsettling.
Makes you think, doesn't it? About what it really means to understand language and what the limits of computation might be.
Yeah, it really does. Like, when you think about how effortlessly you understand a sentence, how you grasp all the nuances of meaning, the emotional undertones, the unspoken implications.
It's still something that computers struggle with, right?
Oh, yeah, big time. We're still a long way from true language understanding, but we're making progress. And who knows, maybe someday we'll have machines that can truly understand us, maybe even better than we understand ourselves.
That's a thought. A little bit scary, but also exciting. Well, if any of these topics have piqued your curiosity, we encourage you to dig deeper. There's a wealth of information out there, and the more you learn about how computers are learning to understand language, the more you'll appreciate the incredible complexity of our own minds.
And who knows, you might even be inspired to contribute to this fascinating field.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.